You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have John Rubino with me once again. DollarCollapse.com. DollarCollapse.com is where you should go to pick up John's articles that he writes frequently and a lot of other good information there. So I should say, I think probably most of you know John, but if there are some of you that are tuning in for the first time today, he is the author of several books. Perhaps the best known one is Money Bubble, which he co-authored with James Turk. He is also very well known for the articles that he writes at DollarCollapse.com and for some of the prestigious magazines in the financial world that he authors, or at least one that I know he is writing articles for from time to time. So he is formerly on Wall Street in the bond market, and so he's a very experienced financial guy. He has also been a host on this show, and all the feedback I get from those of you who listen to John when he took my place at this mic, very, very positive. So in addition to John's expertise, his knowledge, of the financial markets, he's also one of the nicest people that I know personally, so I'm really always pleased to have him with me at this show. Thanks, John, for joining me again.
Sure, Jay. Thanks for having me back.
It's always good to have you, John, and you know, you wrote an article yesterday that I really want to talk about at some point today. You posted it at DollarCollapse.com, and the title is the interest rate death spiral finally starting? And I do want to, because I think that's a very, very timely and very important issue. We just talked to Michael Oliver, who's convinced that the bull market and the T-bond is over, and we're on to a multi-year bear market there. So obviously that's going to have some major impacts on the markets. But before we get to that, I would like to focus a little bit on the topic of Triffin's dilemma, which I know you're familiar with, and also an article that you called attention to. I think you wrote an introduction to. Michael Pinto talked about how the trade war will hurt the United States and the world. So this whole Triffin's dilemma idea states that a country with a reserve currency has to run trade deficits and export jobs. And it seems to me that maybe one of the things that Trump is doing is trying, of course, to reward the electorate, the people that voted him, the people that have probably lost a lot of jobs as a result of the U.S. having the world's reserve currency. But where do you come down on this whole trade issue, John? Now, you know, we've all been taught that free trade is the best thing possible. If it is indeed free trade, I think you can make the argument it's never been completely free. But let's hear your thoughts on Trump's trade policies and what your thoughts are on that topic.
Well, trade policy is why we have President Trump right now. You know, we have, as you said, been in favor of free trade for a long time. But we also recognized that China especially, because we wanted it to transition from being a communist enemy to a capitalist-friendly competitor, needed special treatment for a while on trade. And Europe, while it transitioned away from a bunch of different nation states towards one big superstate, which we also wanted to happen, they needed a little special treatment. So we kind of took one for the team in terms of world trade over the past 20 or 30 years when we accepted kind of unfavorable terms of trade in order to help the world develop. For instance, China was able to build basically the world's manufacturing base over there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And run a huge trade surplus with us, which we accepted because we wanted them to develop. It's kind of the same thing with Europe. We wanted them to be able to coalesce into a stable system that wasn't going to have a world war every 30 or 40 years. But that came at a cost, which is we hollowed out our manufacturing base in the U.S. Mm-hmm. because manufacturing flowed to all these other countries. And that left behind the people who used to have good unionized factory jobs. And they're the ones who voted for Donald Trump, or, you know, who voted populist in general for Bernie mm-hmm. Sanders and for Donald Trump. And so they're Trump's constituency. So it's mm-hmm. no surprise that he's trying to redress the trade imbalances that have built up over the years. And it's also no surprise that he's doing it in a way that's consistent with his business practices in the past. You know, the whole art of the deal thing for Trump, which has kind of sort of served him well over his career in business, is to attack and then work out a deal. In other words, as a businessman, he would file a lawsuit and then cause so much trouble for the people he was suing that they would say, all right, what do we need to get this over with? and then they would cut a deal. So it was nothing personal from his point of view. He was just trying to get the best deal, and contention was the way he would do it. Well, now he's got a lot more tools than just lawsuits, and he's using them, tariffs, the threat of nuclear war, all kinds of other things, to bring people to the negotiating table in the hopes of getting a better deal. And it's working. Europe has already publicly stated that they were going to, you know, rewrite the trade rules vis-a-vis the U.S. and work with Trump to make a different set of rules that are more favorable to us. China and the U.S. just announced that they were going to reopen trade talks. So, mm-hmm. you know, he's kind of getting what he wants. It's arguable whether the cost and the risk are unacceptable, because he's not dealing with, you know, the homeowners association at a condo complex now. He's right. dealing with nuclear powers who are also our creditors. We owe them a lot of money.
mm-hmm. Exactly.
And so it's not clear that it doesn't spin out of control at some point, because we've got a lot of power on all sides mm-hmm. and a lot of people making decisions under pressure without complete information, you know, the way those things usually go. So mm-hmm. this isn't risk-free. But so far, it seems to be working out without the worst-case scenario becoming the most likely outcome. Yeah. And we got to keep our fingers crossed that it continues this way and that we get some deals and that we move on from trade as this big central issue, you know, that we settle things in a way that's somewhat more favorable for us, brings some factory work back to the U.S., satisfies the constituency that voted for Trump. And, you know, it's completely possible, Jay, that the timing of this works out really well electorally, too, because we've got midterm elections coming up pretty soon, which weren't looking good for the Republicans when the trade thing was a source of turmoil in the constituent parts of the country for mm-hmm. Trump. But now if he gets deals before the elections happen, mm-hmm. That gives him a lot of momentum going into those elections with a fairly strong economy, and he's succeeding in keeping his promises. And it's possible that the Republicans are able to hold on to both houses of Congress for another 2 years, which would be a really impressive feat. That doesn't normally happen in American electoral politics anymore.
Right. That's exactly true. Well, John, you said that we took one for the team, and I would suggest that maybe when you say we, not everyone in America took one for the team. For example, it seems to me that one of the things with the reserve currency, one of the reasons we went off the gold standard and took on the world's reserve currency, was so that our military-industrial complex could expand, so we could expand our empire, our markets, and so on and so forth. Certainly, people in government has grown dramatically. With the ability to create money out of nothing, the government, so people that have government jobs, jobs related to people that sell defense items or other things to and through the government that has a checkbook without limits, seemingly without limits, that those people have done quite well. And, of course, the banking institutions have done quite well as well, the financial sector, because we've been able to multiply the money supply, and banks having more money could do more business and so forth. So I'm wondering if that might not have something to do with the divisiveness that we're feeling in America right now, on the financial side anyway, that this whole issue of government getting bigger and people that are closer to the feeding trough, so to speak, doing extremely well at the expense of the people that actually produced wealth-creating jobs, I would argue, mining, manufacturing, and so forth. You know, when a manufacturing plant is set up, it's not just those jobs, but because that brings in new wealth into an economy, then there are service jobs that spring up around there. But if your country is based on primarily on service jobs without those basic wealth creating jobs, it seems to me it's not a very good situation. So would you agree that perhaps when you say we took one for the team, we meaning the whole, yes, but not everybody equally, of course.
Oh yeah, absolutely. A globalized economy is great for symbol manipulators, corporate lawyers, international reporters, people who program computers and do things that require a high level of education mm-hmm. and a high level of intellectual mobility. You do great in a globalized economy because your market gets bigger when mm-hmm. New countries begin trading with your country. But if you're someone who works with physical things, you're at the mercy of wage rates in countries that are less well-developed and are therefore lower, so you tend to lose out. So yeah, we over the past 30 years have seen this huge bifurcation in society in which some groups are doing really, really well. You know, if you're a Goldman Sachs investment banker, this is mm-hmm. the best world ever, and the country's really well-managed, and mm-hmm. things are going great, and we need to stay the course. And if you're a former factory worker who's now a greeter at Walmart, exact opposite.
Right.
And that's why this election, this past election for president was so interesting in the U.S. because we ran a globalist, Hillary mm-hmm. Clinton, who was basically an employee of Wall Street in a lot of ways, who was right. saying that, you know what, we're making progress. We need to continue with current policies because we're doing great. We ran her against a guy who was saying, you know what, rich people are screwing you over. I'm going to fix it. I'm going to stop this immigration madness. I'm going to renegotiate free trade agreements. And he spoke to the constituency that was losing or perceived that it was losing in globalization. And that constituency turned out to be big enough to elect a president. So that's how far along we are, that the people who perceive themselves to be losing can win national elections. So we're at basically 50-50, winners and losers now yeah. in people's minds. And that's an impossible place to be. If half the right. people in your country think that they're losing out, yeah. then you've got political instability as far as the eye can see until things get fixed.
Yeah, well, let's hope they do. I think there's no doubt that this is one of the most tumultuous times I can recall in my lifetime. And I was a young person during the Vietnam era, and that was pretty rocky too in many ways. But let's hope that things get settled. But in that regard, you mentioned a little while ago about all this debt that the U.S. has, which leads me then to another topic I want to make sure we cover today, and that is interest rate death spiral. You ask, is the interest rate death spiral finally starting? John, could you, your article, I should remind our listeners, is posted at dollarcollapse.com. They can go and read that article and many more that John has there. But could you just comment on that perhaps for us now, John? What are your thoughts? What's the answer to that question?
Yeah, well, here's what we've done over the past decade or so. We've pushed interest rates down to historically extremely low levels in order to deal with all the bad debt that was blowing up because of past mistakes. And that allowed us to borrow huge amounts of new money. Well, now we're trying to normalize. In other words, let interest rates go back up to historically normal levels and get the Federal Reserve out of the asset buying with new currency game. But there's a problem with that because of all the debt we've built up. A lot of it is either very short term, which means it has to be rolled over, or it's variable rate, which means it fluctuates according to overall interest rates. And if we let interest rates go up, that means everybody who has to roll over debt or who has variable rate debt sees their interest costs go up. So the U.S. government, for instance, has very low interest costs today. But mm-hmm. let interest rates go up to the level that was normal back in the 1990s, not even high, just normal, mm-hmm. prior to the great monetary experiment that began in 2000. And we would see our interest costs at just the central bank or central government level go up over $1 trillion. That means that we're already running pretty close to $1 trillion a year deficit right now. Add right. another $1 trillion that we would have to borrow in interest costs, and you'd see this death spiral begin in which our debts continue to increase and interest rates go up, which means the cost of that debt goes up even faster than the debt is going up, which eventually blows up the system. And it won't take long for that to happen, and it won't take a big rise in interest rates. We don't have to go to unusual interest rates, just normal interest rates, for that to happen. And that's true everywhere in the world, and it's true beyond central governments. It's true for corporations. It's true for individuals. And when this thing really gets going, we'll see this extraordinary disruption in the financial system where everybody's interest costs are rising, and that bankrupts growing numbers of economic entities out there and starts the system spinning downward into a probably unstoppable descent until we either have a hyperinflation or a global 1930s-style depression. And interest rates could be the key to that process.
Well, Michael Oliver, who we had on before you, his technical work is suggesting that the bull market for the T-bonds that started back in the early 80s is over, and he believes the first stop would be, it would take us to a T-bond yield of something like 4.5, I think he said, or 4.25. What would that be enough to cause us some real problems?
Oh, definitely. A 4% average borrowing cost for the U.S. government would give us an $840 billion a year interest bill, just interest, in addition to everything else.
Oh, my
goodness. And that would be probably bad enough to scare everybody. And once you scare everybody, it's game over in a fiat currency system. So, yeah, that would do it. But the perception that it was going to continue is what would be really dangerous. Because if rates go to 4%, people start thinking, well, interest rates are rising. So 5, 6, 7, you know, we extrapolate our recent experience into the indefinite future. That's how the human mind works. And at that point, we see numbers that are impossible to manage. And then everybody basically just leaves financial assets because nobody wants to be involved with bonds if you think interest rates are going to continue to rise, because that means the value of your bond is going to crash. And if you think interest rates are going to go up, then you don't want to own stocks so much either, because their dividend yields look less and less attractive relative to higher and higher bond yields. So you want to keep your powder dry until you see a top in bonds and then jump in. You know, back in the early 1980s, treasury bond yields went to 16%.
Mm-hmm. I know.
And that can never happen again. But if we even start trending in that direction, it'll blow up the financial system. So we're at a very dangerous place. What will probably happen is that the Fed will recognize this and then go back to quantitative easing. Instead of quantitative tightening, which we've got now, where they're trying to normalize, they'll cut rates to negative levels that we've never seen in the U.S., and they'll start buying back financial assets hand over fist with newly created currency, and that'll set the stage for the next hyperinflationary cycle. And probably the final one in this fiat currency system. So, Jay, that's when you want to own gold and silver, of course. You know, well, all roads lead back to precious metals.
Yeah, I think you definitely want to have tangible assets, and, of course, the most portable of them, gold and silver. Gold even more than silver, of course. Yeah, I should remind and tell our listeners that there are, you know, just some of the items that we'd like to talk about, but we don't have enough time today. Another article that you wrote, Public Sector Pensions, The Parasite Devours the Host. Another one is U.S. Housing Bubble Enters State 2. Suddenly Motivated Sellers Are Out There. Another one, which maybe you could comment just on briefly, will Disney's epic buyout of Fox mark the end of the everything bubble? Give us your thoughts on that, John.
Yeah, well, past financial bubbles have seen bigger and bigger takeovers. As people get cocky and they have access to insane amounts of cash, they tend to start building empires. And you see these big takeovers, like America Online took over Time Warner back in the late 1990s. And that kind of rang the bell for the end of that cycle when something that outrageous happened. And soon after that, tech stocks collapsed. And it's possible that we're seeing something like that now, because we've seen some really big corporate mergers and acquisitions take place just lately, because money has been so available, so easy for big companies. And Disney Fox is a huge takeover. one which consolidates the media world even further in the hands of fewer and fewer corporations. And so it's possible that looking back on it, we'll say, okay, that was the end right there. That's when we should have known that the system had run its course in this cycle. So pay attention to that, how it goes. I think it's going to happen. It looks like the other bidders have dropped out. It looks like Fox has agreed to be bought out by Disney. And we'll see where that goes. You know, it's building a total media powerhouse, but Disney has to borrow a ton of money to do it.
All right. Very interesting. Well, John, with just a couple of minutes left here yet, another article you noted, Marin Katusa, was turning very bullish on junior gold mining stocks. Could you just comment on that briefly, and then possibly also what you see in terms of the gold and silver futures action turning point, which you also wrote about? And again, all these articles can be read at dollarcollapse.com.
Well, Marin Katusa is a very well-known, very highly respected commodities analyst. And his take is that he's agnostic on the price of gold. It might go up or it might not go up soon, you know, in the next year. But that while that's happening, the big mining companies are using up their gold reserves faster than they're replenishing them. That's going to lead them to buy out the junior miners who have already found decent-sized reserves because the big guys can't find enough on their own, which is great for the prices of the explorers and the other junior miners, which means everybody should subscribe to your newsletter, Jeff, because it's the perfect time for that.
I think it could be. Yeah, we're certainly at the bottom. I think we have to be close to it if we're not there. Yeah.
Yeah. And as for the state of the gold market right now, the stars are lining up pretty positively, I think. We've got the Commitment of Traders report, which is the positioning of futures contract players in gold, looking incredibly bearish from the point of view of what those guys are doing. Speculators are as bearish as they've ever been, and that's traditionally a bullish signal. In other words, when the guys who trade mostly on emotion and momentum are terrified, that's usually the end of the bear market in something. And gold has been going down for a while. The speculators are terrified, and that implies that that we've got an upmarket coming for gold that'll last a few months. That'll take us into the seasonally really strong period for gold and silver when India and China do most of their buying, which usually also gives gold and silver a nice pop. So we could have everything lined up all at once for a very nice run for gold and silver, starting in September or so, and then running through January or February of 2019, which is also great for the junior miners because they're very volatile. They go up and down more than gold and silver. So let precious metals go up, the little miners will rock it.
I like what I hear, from as they say, from your mouth to God's ears, I think someone says. But anyway, I hope you're right, because certainly for selfish reasons. John, I want to thank you so much for being with us again today. Always a pleasure having you with us. Always your insights are always very much appreciated by me and my listeners, so we'll look forward to doing it again sometime in the near future. Well, folks, that is all the time we have today. Next week, Alistair MacLeod will be with me to talk about how are you going to value gold in a world that's awash in fiat currency. Should be an interesting topic along the lines of what John was just talking about, perhaps, and Ivan Bebek will be with me as well. He gave us an update on RN Resources, one of those stocks that's been languishing at the bottom for some time. I expect Ivan will have some refreshing news to give us. And hopefully, I think we'll have Michael Oliver back as well. So that is all the time we have this week. Until next week, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Bonterra Resources, an advanced exploration company, is aggressively expanding its high-grade Gladiator gold deposit in Quebec, Canada. Over the last 12 months, Bonterra has raised over $60 million and has attracted strategic investors Eric Sprott, Kirkland Lake Gold, and New York-based Vanek Gold Fund. Bonterra is focused on updating its 43-101 resource in the second half of 2018 and will incorporate up to an additional 100,000 meters of drilling, where the dimensions of the Gladiator deposit have been expanded to date nearly 500%. Bonterra trades in Canada under the symbol BTR and in the U.S. under the symbol BONXF.
Often referred to as one of the best teams in junior gold exploration, having discovered a 5 million ounce gold mine and sold a second company amidst discovery, the management behind Orin Resources now has a world-class exploration portfolio within Canada and Peru. Projects that give the company one of the largest direct pipelines for major discoveries globally, with one of the deepest technical teams to explore them. Entering into its third year of aggressive pursuit, Orin is expecting results from two of their major projects throughout the rest of this year. For the latest, head to orinresources.com and subscribe.